You're listening to 98.7, Your Story Counts with Simone and Nan. We're heading for a top of 11 degrees. And in the studio today, we have the big-hearted, handsome, inspirational Jeff Nyson. Welcome.
Woo-hoo.
Thank you. I don't know about handsome, but I'm big
you
in
are.
Some respects. Being 6'6", you know?
Definitely. That's definitely been helpful for you, hasn't it, in the basketball years?
Well, it did help back in the days of the Southern Peninsula Sharks, mm-hmm. back in their formation, actually.
So. Yeah, fabulous. Well, we're so lucky to have you here today. We're going to be having a bit of a natter about what has been your journey and how you've chosen to be, like you said, Simone, an absolute inspiration to all of us. So let's get started. Yeah. Now, you're a bit of a local lad, is that right?
I am. Interestingly, I was born about 1 kilometre away from here in, we're living in Glen Eagles Avenue at the time, just down here in Mornington.
Yeah.
And I guess spent all of my growing years on the peninsula.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, indeed. Oh, look, it's a beautiful place. So I feel very lucky to have been brought up down here. It's a gorgeous place to have been brought up, and that's what's inspired me to bring my kids up on the peninsula. It's such a fantastic community to be a part of, and young adult thing in going away for a few years for university, and went overseas for a few years, but always knew that we'd be back.
Mm. So, did you actually live overseas for a period of time as well?
Yeah, I did. I did. Okay. My girlfriend, well, then girlfriend, now wife, Sarah, we went over.
Phew, I thought you were going to say, you know, then no, girlfriend, but no longer.
No, not bringing out any skeletons today. Leave them where they belong.
That's right.
No, Sarah and I went over to the UK. Mm-hmm. We spent 4 years over there, both mm-hmm. working and travelling. And, I'm of the opinion that everybody's got to spend some time
Absolutely.
Of their life living overseas. It gives you perspective and it helps you appreciate what you've got when you do come home.
Mm. Mm. I know I've been coming down here since I was about, I think, 9, but you were lucky enough to actually be here from, you know, the beginning.
Yeah. That's
from inception.
I often drive past where the old site of the Mornington Bush Hospital. That's where I was born.
And, wow. Yeah.
It's no Beautiful. Longer there now. I think it's a nursing home now.
Oh,
I'm
is it?
Sure. I think so. I'm not sure. I'm not entirely sure.
It was just such a beautiful place when we were kids. I mean, most of the roads were dirt roads, and I mean, that's where we got our license, isn't it? That's where we learnt how to drive, how to fishtail, how to, you know, drive from 0 to 100 in a millisecond.
Fishtail. Now, that brings up memories. Going too fast around, as I had my license for 3 weeks and I was driving around the dirt roads on Arthur Seat as a young kid. And having only had my license for 3 weeks, I was going a bit fast and started fishtailing.
As we all did.
Ended up rolling my car.
Oh, really?
No. So
it's left an indelible mark in me. I'm sure I've got a scar here somewhere.
Really?
Courtesy of Arthur Seat. But everybody was okay, so.
Yeah, it was.
Did you have other people in the car?
Yes. Oh, I had one other person in the car at the time. And as I said, no one was hurt. But a learning experience.
For
Arthur Seat taught me a lesson.
Yeah, Arthur Seat, there's a bit of technique needed, isn't there?
Especially if you want a fishtail.
<That's right. laughs> You need to be able to straighten up. That's right. That's it. Fantastic. Yeah. And I last week we chatted, obviously we had the, you know, show on Kate Sobrano, and you told a funny story about the fact that you wanted to go and see her at 16.
Yeah, well, it wasn't my idea. I was up in Frankston with my older brother, Chris. He was 19 at the time. I was actually 15. And he said, look, either you can get the bus home, and back in those days it was a 50-minute cold, dreary bus ride on bus ride from Frankston down to Rosebud, or alternatively you can hang out with me and we can see if we can get you into the 21st Century Dance Club to go and see Kate Sobrano. So I was sitting there as a 15-year-old, weighing up
really?
The options. Well, I weighed him up for about 30 seconds.
Exactly.
And then I was like, yeah, all right, let's do it. Do you think I'll get in? And he goes, it's a 21st Century Dance Club. You probably won't because, you know, they're pretty tight with their security there, but let's give it a shot.
But you would have had height on your side at
I
that age.
Did. I did.
Yeah, and the looks.
I was tall, skinny. I think I had long hair back then too, so I could cover the fact that I didn't have any maturity growth.
Any facial hair?
No facial hair whatsoever. In we went and amazingly, I got in, and it was the proudest moment Walking into high school the next day.
For sure, going. You know,
banging
high
my
five.
Chest, saying, I went and saw Kate Sobrano at the 21st Century Dance Club.
Absolutely.
That was the high. I guess the low was when I got home and my stepmom said to me, she said, what did you do last night? Having already found out that I went to the 21st Century Dance Club. Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a leading question. It was a small village.
Did you learn that young about what women do when they ask those sort of questions?
She set me up. No, I was young and I was innocent. Mm. I had no idea how the knowledge of mums. I had no idea whatsoever. But I was soon found out when I said, oh, nothing. We were just at my brother's house playing cards. And she said, you liar. So I ended up getting grounded. I got grounded 2 weeks for going to the 21st Century Dance Club and 6 weeks for lying. So,
ow.
Early lessons.
Yeah, absolutely.
Harsh lessons, but early lessons.
That's that high and low, isn't it? High fiving, you know, going to school. I'm the man to actually, I can't go out for 2 months.
Check me out. I'll actually check me out because I'm not coming out for the next 2 months.
Oh, fantastic. So, yeah, so a very relaxed kind of, you know, happy childhood, it sounds like.
Oh, look, it was great. Look, whilst I was born in Mornington, we soon moved down to Rosebud and spent a lot of years. We owned the milk bar. It's now called the Corner Milk Bar on the corner of Boney Hill Road and Nepean Hill.
Right.
So, you know, my young years, I remember riding my bike up and down the foreshore, playing over at the swimming pool that used to be there, riding the water slides when they got installed, and you know, the memories of summer tourism, you know, because the population would explode.
Yeah.
And being in the
still
shop.
Does.
And you would have got today. And you would have got lollies for free.
Lollies
you would have been able to go
free.
In there and just fill bags of lollies.
Yeah, because you're local.
Because like, I had a milk bar.
Milk bar. I was thinking about the slides, and they would know you'd be like Jeff Nyson's arrived, right? Let him in for free.
No, we're only ever allowed lollies on a Friday night. It was the Friday night we're allowed to have a choice of whatever chocolate bar we wanted, and then we're allowed to go and watch the Friday night movie and then to bed.
So you didn't ever sneak any lollies in between?
Well, I could, but my parents would find out and ground me again. So
this grounding thing is awful.
It was an awesome childhood, you know, because I'm one of nine kids.
Massive.
Yeah, to have a big family. Most people, at least Rosebud Way and up onto up towards Frankston, have heard of the Nyson clan, just because there's so many of us.
Where did you fall?
I'm in the middle.
In the middle.
In the middle. I'm what, number five? So,
okay.
It made for interesting times at the dinner table.
Did you have a big enough
feeding time at the zoo?
It makes you appreciate food and how to fight for it.
And you do. You eat so fast.
Do I? I've never noticed.
For sure.
I was just dying off your food.
That's right. Watch all your food.
The person who finishes first gets first choice at leftovers.
Yeah. So. Wow, okay.
That's what it's all about.
And you loved your sport. You got right into your sport, didn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Like playing up in Frankston, I played up for the old Stoners up there. The YCW, and then moving down to Rosebud, played for Rosebud Football Club. As I said, was one of the first players, you know, that joined the Southern Peninsula Sharks when they started their men's CVIBL team. So in the formative years there, so football, basketball, all the normal things, I guess, that Aussie kids play in the backyard.
And then you found yourself getting into your career. Can you tell me a little bit about that? So you started taking yourself a little bit more seriously at this point.
Yeah, as one of nine kids, Dad took the opportunity to boot us out. He said, look, I'll get you through to through your high school years, but then you're off to uni. Got through uni quite well, you know. But then I found what I wanted to do once I started working and I started
environmental. What was your first job?
My first professional job was working in a laboratory, a chemistry laboratory, analysing all sorts of samples, also doing air quality testing, everything in that environment sphere for a small consulting firm up in Coburg. And then from there progressed in working for a multinational company working in the environmental consultancy field, but specialising in contaminated site management. So basically going on to industrial sites and looking for contamination, historic and legacy contamination, helping them deal with issues that might later affect the environment, workers on site. So,
and that's both here in Australia and overseas?
It was a good job because it enabled me to travel with it. And so I've been lucky enough, as I said with Sarah earlier, I've been lucky enough to travel the world working through Europe, through Africa, in the US, through Asia, and all over Australia doing environmental consultancy. So I've been lucky in that regard.
So when did you come back home?
We got back in, 2005. And we came back a little bit sooner than what I thought we were going to come back. We were halfway through roughly a 10-month journey around the world, because when I finished up in the UK working... we decided to travel. And while we were travelling, we thought, look, quite a number of our friends, Sarah and I were engaged at the time, and we decided that quite a number of our friends were having a hard time having kids. So, look, we're going to get married as soon as we get home. So we won't try to have kids, but, you know, we'll just see what happens.
Have some fun.
And seriously, 2 weeks later, bang, pregnant.
Yeah.
And so
swimmers did well.
I remember being in Vancouver over in the States. We had another 2 months of travel ahead of us, and Sarah said, guess what, we're pregnant. And then she started feeling unwell.
Oh, no. The morning sickness kicked
and
in.
And then Sarah said, that's it. I've had enough of this travel. Let's go home. So we took the 41-hour speed trek home. And we landed home, I think it was about the 4th of February. I remember it was the 4th of February because that's Sarah's birthday in 2005.
Ah, good stuff. So then you sort of settled back in, you had your career going, you know, obviously again, you know, things were really moving for you from an executive point of view.
Yeah, look, I was pretty fixated on corporate progression. And, you know, I wanted to be the best that I could be. I wanted to work hard and you know, really climb that corporate ladder. I was fixed on being the best that I could be and really aspiring to the top job sort of thing, you know. Whatever that could be. I didn't know where, you know, what the top job was going to be for me, but I just wanted to continue to progress.
And what was the driver for that? Was that for security for your family, or was that just because it's a challenge, you know, and you love that idea of being the best you can be? Or what was it that drove you?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Like, when I reflect on it, sometimes I'm not entirely sure I had a definitive driver. I just wanted to be the best at what I was doing. I'm a competitive beast, and yeah, I think I just wanted to be the best that I could be. I wasn't particularly caught up in that corporate world, in that I, you know, corporate was everything. If I actually stopped and pulled things apart, corporate isn't what I wanted to do, but it was what I was doing. Yeah. And so, you know,
and you were good at it.
I was good at it. There were no other squeaky wheels, so why not progress there? It's, you know, you get compensated financially. A lot of your friends, you form a lot of good friendships in that space, especially when you're spending 10, 12 hours a day at work every day. That's where you just follow the stream, you know, you get taken along.
So, you know, you had two kids at this point.
Two gorgeous kids, yeah, is Riley that right? And Georgia. So Georgia now is 8 and Riley's 11. They're both
beautiful kids.
Yeah, Canyon Primary School in Mount Eliza. So, and you know, we love being in this community. It's gorgeous. And, you know, my kids are reveling in it and getting to experience what I used to experience as a kid growing up.
So tell me about that day when you're playing basketball.
The day? Are you talking February the 18th? Okay. So it was just a normal day, and like it was a normal day for a normal guy. That's what it felt like to me. I started the day, went off to work, and you know, worked hard like I did every day. I guess I was leading a team of 40 people at the time, and my concerns were all about, you know, what my concerns were every day, making sure that the team was busy, had plenty of work to do, making sure that, you know, we were procuring the next opportunity. I was pulling together bids for work to be done down on a major project down in Hastings. And so it was, in all respects, it was just a normal day. I guess on that normal day, I did what I always did on a Tuesday and went and played basketball at Frankston. And in playing basketball, I guess the backstory there is I just turned 40 years of age, and I was playing basketball with a group of young kids. And by young kids, they were, you know, 19 and 20. And after the game, they were chucking the ball up and they were dunking the ball, as young kids do. I just turned 40 and I thought to myself,
I can do that.
I reckon I can still do that. Well, let's see if I can anyway.
I would so do that.
And I got the ball and I've gone the run up and bang, dunked it. Yep. It's like, yes, I can still dunk it. Yeah, I'm 40, yeah. Check me out. For Give sure. me the ball again, I'm going to do it again.
Yeah.
I did it again and my shoulder went pop.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And I thought, here we go. Old man injury. I've dislocated my shoulder. So, and I was lucky enough to have my mum there. Like, doesn't every 40-year-old guy have his
mum watching
cheering him on, watching him play basketball. And I said to my mum, I think you got to call an ambulance. I've just dislocated my shoulder and it's about to really start hurting. So, get an ambulance here and make sure they've got morphine on board.
Yeah. Well, we want to hear more about Jeff's story after a little bit of Shawn Mendes. This is Emily's favourite that she asked for today. You're listening to RPP, Your Story Counts.
You're listening to 98.7, Your Story Counts, with Simone and Nan. And in the studio we have the very handsome Jeff Nyson.
Didn't we agree I was tall as opposed to handsome?
No, you're more handsome. You're more handsome than tall.
Okay. Gina.
Gee, that's the first time you've ever been told that.
That's right. I'm 2 metres tall, so more handsome than tall.
Jeez, that's really...
Tall's overrated. That's
a big compliment. I'm going red now.
I know, yeah. It's the first time I've ever seen you go red.
I'm easily embarrassed.
We've been chatting about your story, about the fact that you're a local boy, you know, grew up down here, and but also travelled extensively with your career. You know, you've had obviously got a beautiful wife, Sarah, and two gorgeous kids. You came home for that in about, what was it, 2005?
2005, we landed back.
2005, you came back. Loving life here, but really pursuing a big career, and found yourself playing basketball with your mum watching at 40.
Showing off.
Doing a slam dunk.
Yeah, that's what it comes down to. I shouldn't have been showing off.
Yeah, fabulous. So, but you went off and you did two slam dunks and found that something happened with your shoulder and it seemed to pop out.
Yeah, so what happened next?
Well, the ambulance came and ferried me off to hospital and... you know, the doctors did a heap of scans and they said, don't worry, look, you've probably just dislocated your shoulder and we'll put it back in pretty quickly. 10 minutes later, though, after having done some x-rays, they came up to me and they said, look, can you explain to us what you did in damaging your shoulder? Like, did you land on the ground? Because you haven't dislocated at all. It's you've shattered your shoulder. Your upper humerus bone has basically fallen apart. And it was a bit of a shock at the time. And so basically that, I guess led me to 3-4 weeks of doing, copious amounts of testing and what have you on what the cause of, you know, my upper humerus bone falling apart. And it was, mid-March when I was told that, I had been diagnosed with multiple myeloma, which is a form of incurable blood cancer.
Wow.
It was, yeah, look. You know, I guess the day that you get told that you've got multiple myeloma is never a good day. Day you get, you know, told that you've got cancer, it's challenging. Yeah.
So did they explain it in detail? Did you have to Google it?
Interestingly, they didn't. I found out at 2 o'clock from a non-myeloma specialist that I had myeloma. And he said, look, in 2 hours' time, I've organised a meeting for you with a specialist.
You had to wait 2 hours?
So I had to wait 2 hours. And, like, when you say, did I Google it? Of course, I went straight down to the
Dr.
car.
Dr. Google?
I was sitting in. I actually, well, I did what any computer literate person does and went straight to Wikipedia.
Yeah.
And what did Wikipedia tell me? Well, Wikipedia gave me a bit of information. They told me that multiple myeloma, it's treatable, but there's no cure. Mm-hmm. I found out through Wikipedia that I, you know, with conventional treatment, I only had 3 to 4 years to live. Could have been extended to 5 to 7 years, given my age, being such a young person. I found out that the average age of diagnosis for someone with multiple myeloma is 70 years of age.
Wow. Yeah.
So having just turned 40, I felt
it's
a little
like
ripped
that
off.
Yeah, that doesn't add up.
That's it, thoroughly ripped off there. And I guess the real kicker is that, as I said, the prognosis. Finding out that you've only got a couple of years to live, I guess that was some of the most challenging moments I've experienced in my life, that's for sure.
I mean, that 2 hours wait would have been horrific. Like, you know.
Interestingly, the first thing we wanted to do, I'm a real communicator, and I'm very connected in with my friends and my family.
Community and
My family means everything to me, and when I say family, I mean extended family, my brothers and sisters and what have you. And so the first thing I did was communicate back to everybody, because everybody was, you know, had known about me for the prior couple of weeks. So there was a lot of anticipation in what we were going to find out on that day. But what Sarah and I did was we actually went into a park in the middle of Melbourne, and we just sat under a tree, and I can go back to the tree now. I remember it very succinctly, and we just sat there and took a deep breath and, you know, just tried to take stock of our new predicament.
Wow. Yeah.
So
because you knew that things weren't going to be the same from that moment.
And that it's a very poignant thing you say, because basically everything's turned upside down, you know. You think about the Tuesday, we spoke about what, you know, I did on the Tuesday, and it's a normal guy doing normal things. And then, you know, the day after, I'm in a position where, philosophically, the day after, I'm sitting in a position where my whole life's turned upside down. All of a sudden, I've only got a couple of years to live.
It's a defining moment about multiple myeloma, isn't it? That you actually feel fine, like you were a healthy lad, life was good, there was no symptoms.
Yeah, until, you're absolutely right.
You know, you were playing basketball.
Yeah, I was on top of the world. As I said, I just I was doing everything a normal person would do, and I didn't have a care in the world other than, you know, the average person's worries. And you're right, there are no definitive symptoms associated with multiple myeloma. Basically, the nature of the disease is that it grows within your bone marrow. It's actually a rogue bone marrow cell, if you want to call it that, or a plasma cell. It displaces the bone marrow, and the effects that you would see is you would see a degenerating immune system, because as your bone marrow is displaced and you get less bone marrow produces your blood. Your blood is your immune system, and that's the challenge. You start getting a degenerating immune response to, you know, colds and flus and these sorts of things. I guess the second thing is that it attacks the bones because it resides within the bone. It actually starts termiting and it can really play havoc on your bones. And that's how it, I guess, came out with me. It presented itself as a bone lesion and, you know, hence destroyed my upper humerus bone.
Wow. And you're so active.
Yeah,
it's the body's a miraculous thing, you know. I look back then and you'd think that I was never going to be able to use my arm again, or that I'd have to do something serious to my arm. But over the ensuing couple of months post diagnosis, my arm miraculously healed itself with treatment. You know, I can run, I can swim, I can play basketball. I'm really lucky from that perspective.
Amazing. And the different treatment that you adopted, you combined complementary medicine with the medical model.
Well, that's how we met, isn't it?
That's how we met. Yeah.
I did. Look, I guess one of the perspectives when you're diagnosed with an incurable disease, you want to do everything you can to help yourself. And so with assistance from friends and family, and especially my beautiful wife, Sarah, we went on a bit of a mission to identify things that could bring a bit of basically stack the chips in on my side as opposed to it all being on the cancer side. Because one of the big things that you experience is the total loss of control, you know. On the Tuesday, I was playing basketball and I had everything ahead of me. I was in control of my life in every aspect, as I thought. The next day, you've got no control. Like all of your holidays have gone out the window. I didn't work for the next 12 months with my arm and with all the treatment that I had to go through. You don't know which way's up simply because you have no control over, or you seemingly have no control over your destiny.
Well, for the first time, your body has let you down.
Absolutely.
And it's scary.
It is. It really is.
Because we just think our body's going to just keep going.
Keep up with us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just don't expect that.
And then it's compounded with sadness. Not only sadness that I felt, but also Well, the sadness that I felt was a reflection of those people around me. I wasn't worried for myself. I've got a very strong belief in myself and, and what I can do. But I was sad when I looked around me and saw all of my friends and family, you know, really worried because all of us were sitting in a place of disempowerment.
Yeah, they felt helpless.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, we had to turn it around somehow. And you know, as you introduced complementary therapies. Complementary therapies was one way in which I could wrestle control away from the beast of cancer.
It is such a difficult position to be in, particularly multiple myeloma, because as you had mentioned to me once, it's like, you know, you sort of feel blessed that you're diagnosed because at least you can do something about it. But at the same time, it's difficult to be diagnosed because you were so happy before it even started. So it's, and it's not like the cancer was giving you any trouble until that moment. But, you know, then it's a case of, okay, well, what do I need to change in my body? You know, and that's both medical model as well as complementary medicine. And also getting yourself aligned within yourself to keep yourself motivated, you know, and clean and clear and, you know, passionate about your life when everything had changed. How does that feel for you now, knowing that that's sort of what you've been through?
Look, it now seems like the obvious path to go down is to, you know, assess your options and look at what you can do. But I guess reflecting back then, you don't know what to do. You're the real challenge is that there's so much white noise. There's so many people giving you polar opinions what to do and how to do it. It's not dissimilar to when you first have a baby.
Baby, I know. Everyone's got their opinions.
And everybody comes out. Everyone's like the armchair experts on what to do and how to do it. And so, and because there are so many polarized opinions on complementary therapies versus, you know, the big bad pharmaceuticals, I realized that I needed to embrace the information and embrace the, I guess, the path that was going to get me to where I needed to be. And what I've found is it's a mix of both. I need to be empowered through complementary therapies and in making sure that I'm doing everything to keep my immune system as strong as it can be. Meanwhilest, I also need to dance with the pharmaceuticals because, you know, they do a lot of good work in identifying and discovering these drugs that do keep the cancer at bay.
Everybody's physical body responds differently. That's the hard thing.
It is so individualistic, especially with myeloma. Myeloma is one of those cancers that, you know, they stick these drugs into me and you adopt these alternate therapies. And it is really a road of discovery as to whether they're going to work or not. And that's disempowering.
Yeah.
But at the same time, when it works, you know, you're punching the air.
that's right.
For sure.
So what I loved about working with you was how you wanted to create that sense of community. You know, a lot of people have mentioned this to me, is you've made talking about cancer an easy process and an open-hearted process. You know, where you feel comfortable educating people and you want to inspire people to say, you know what, you know, there's so much you can do with this, you know, that you can actually expand as to who you are rather than sort of, you know, I guess, shrink and hide away. You know, and that's really what you've done. You've really embraced that part of you.
Well, in becoming empowered, what I realized was that health is one portion of the pie. And when I look at my whole life, there's so much more to me than just my health. Health's a major part, but I found that I was in a position where I couldn't control health. So what I had to do was focus on things that I could control, and in engaging people around me, I quickly realized that I could only do as much as what one person could do. But when I started adding a lot of amazing people into my healing team, all of a sudden 1 + 1 = 5, right? So I quickly found myself in a position where by engaging people and by focusing not being singularly dimensionally focused on health, by focusing on every aspect of my life, whether it be my family, my career, because I had to, you know, maintain some form of livelihood, where I started looking at my community and engaging with my community, it was huge for me because I found that I could engage those people around me, educate them in some ways, inspire them in some ways. But at the same time, it was also self-fulfilling because I got so much out of it. And so by putting my focus in other spaces and by, empowering myself in other areas, it started to minimize the destruction that was cancer.
Okay, amazing story. So let's just listen to a little bit of Ed Sheeran and then we're going to be back with Jeff Nyson's story.
You're listening to 98.7 Your Story Counts with Simone and Nan. And in the studio we have Jeff Nyson.
And who's tall.
That's true. Right. And so inspiring. Big hearted. Big, big hearted. Say no more.
So there we go. Yeah, so we've been nattering like crazy. We were talking so much in the break. I know. We suddenly realised, oh, we're back on.
Exactly.
Which is always the way with Jeff. Hey, so we've been, just going through your story. As we said before, if someone's just tuned in, local boy who hung out, had a great childhood, you know, surfing and cycling and family owned a milk bar so he could steal lollies every Friday, although yeah. I think he stole them and more than every Friday.
Yep. Just don't tell my parents.
You know, he was number 5 of 9 kids.
Exactly. It was competitive.
So there's a real tribe and a lovely close family today. You know, he went through, a really wonderfully successful career. Life was great. Beautiful, beautiful wife, couple of kids. You know, everything was on the move. Mm-hmm. And then there was that day where he went up and, was playing basketball. And went up for that big goal and basically popped his shoulder, and that found him. That's when he found himself in hospital.
Yeah, diagnosed with multiple myeloma. Mm.
Where life was very different from that moment on.
Yeah, it sure was.
So we were just chatting about obviously how you've been managing your own, I guess, what we call a treatment plan of a combination of complementary medicine as well as, the medical model.
So what are your challenges now?
I guess the challenges sit within the biggest challenge really sits in uncertainty. Mm. I've been through a lot with treatment. It started with, low-dose chemotherapy goes into high-dose chemotherapy and a stem cell transplant. That was back in 2014. That kept me in good stead for a couple of years. In October of last year, those pesky cancer cells reared their ugly head again. And so with the relapse, I went through induction therapy through to... the induction therapy is low-dose chemotherapy back into another stem cell transplant, which I went through only 4 weeks ago. So it was a really challenging undertaking this time around. The first time I had my stem cell transplant, I breezed through, relatively speaking, and felt quite well all the way through. This time it pretty much nailed me. I really had a hard time with it. But at the same time, all the symptoms were well understood. I knew that that's what could happen, and it happened this time. So you just have to do what you have to do to get through it, get through that dark tunnel and get to the other side so that way you can be as fit and well as you can, because in 4 weeks' time I've got a second stem cell transplant coming up. Now, the second stem cell transplant is where I actually receive stem cells from my brother.
Wow.
So it's called an allogeneic stem cell transplant. And I guess I'm lucky enough to have a sibling who was a suitable match for me and could donate his stem cells for me to use. It's my best chance at getting long-term remission. Mm-hmm. But as I mentioned, the biggest challenge is uncertainty, with the nature of myeloma and cancer in general. You know, they stick these, they apply these treatments and they stick these hardcore chemicals in they hope. Mm. And by hardcore chemicals, a lot of the chemicals aren't discriminatory in how they attack your body. They go in and they attack fast replicating cells. So that's why people lose their hair. Hair is a fast replicating cell. And so you lose your hair because the chemotherapy goes in and indiscriminately starts attacking the cancer, but it also attacks your body. That's why it's such a challenge. Mm.
So what was the difference between the first one to the second one that you've just had?
I'm not sure. I think in a lot of ways I was lucky with the first one. I think that my body was probably a lot stronger with the first one simply because it hadn't been through several rounds of chemotherapy. Mm. I think luck plays a big part in there. I was quite lucky the first time. I think from a mental perspective, I've been very strong throughout both of them, and I've been able to tolerate them both well. But, you know, unfortunately, this time I got an infection and I was a bit unlucky.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so that must have been pretty scary, I'm sure, for yourself, but also the people around you.
Yeah, look, it is, but you're in good hands at the same time. You know, the first stem cell transplant, the autologous stem cell transplant is pretty well understood. And whilst it's scary, I guess they're scared for me in that, you know, they see me being so unwell. And it's not nice when you see your friends and family or anyone unwell.
Well, it's the unknown, isn't it, really?
It is. Very much is the unknown. And that's where, you know, this next stem cell transplant, you know, there's a 15% fatality rate associated with the stem cell transplant itself. And, you know, someone gave me a bit of perspective on that the other day, and they said, you know, if you found out that, what, on average, one in six people, if you went parachuting and you found out that one in six people died doing it, you just wouldn't do it, would you? if I had a choice, I wouldn't do it.
That puts in perspective, for sure.
It is. But at the same time, you put your faith in, you've got to put your faith in yourself. You've got to put your faith in your body's ability to progress through the treatment that's coming up. And you know, 85% of people, 85% plus, progress through this stem cell transplant and do really well out of it. So,
and that's the thing, that how do you trust your body again? How do you get that relationship with trust around that?
Well, the reality is that I don't have a choice. It's sink or swim. If I have to trust my body, because if I don't trust my body, then you're going into a dark space, aren't you? And you know, you're in a situation where, like, I love there's a quote that is, you know, you don't try and hide from the storm; you learn to enjoy the rain. You know, and that's what you've got to do. You've got to get out in the rain and
get wet,
enjoy it, and
stomp around.
Do things that you know, empower you, do things that energize you, live deliberately. You know, I often ask people, you know, who's got a bucket list, and everybody puts their hands up and says, yeah, I've got a bucket list item at least, and it's like, that's great, so how long before you're going to achieve that item? And most people don't have a time frame around.
No, they don't. They're leaving it in the future.
Well, everyone's going to live forever. Why would it? There's no urgency. But I have a different perspective on that, and that I create bucket list items, but I also put a time frame on those bucket list items. Why? Because when I complete that item, it means I'm living a fabulous life.
Yeah, full.
And then I can replenish that bucket list item with a whole new set of bucket list items and continue to have a fabulous life by being bigger and better and achieving the things that I want to achieve in my life, regardless of how long I'm going to be here for. Because I am going to be here till I'm 80. I haven't said that
absolutely.
Yet.
Absolutely. Sure. I'm here doing beautiful push-ups. Silver.
That's it. This tall guy is going to be here, as they're gracing your airwaves for a long time to come.
Absolutely. We'll be getting you back on an RPP. You know, he's here again.
I know.
Yeah, so you'll get sick of me.
What is next on your bucket list?
Next on my bucket list. Oh, look, a lot of it revolves around. I've got big audacious goals on my bucket list, but I've also got really simple things on my bucket list.
It's good to have both.
It is, like, because at the end of the day, life isn't all about big and audacious. No. It's about the simple things as well. One of the things on my bucket list is that, and it started some time ago, is I want to walk my kids to school 300 times. Because if I walk my kids either to or from school, it means I'm spending the time with them to know who they are, what they're doing, who their mates are, and I'm getting that one-on-one contact time with the kids. So it's something as simple as that to something as audacious as, well, I've just ticked off one of my bucket lists in running the My Manalyzer Run and Fun Festival. I come up with a zany idea that I wanted to give back to my community, and I wanted to give back to Myeloma Australia, which is a fantastic organisation that does great work in support of myeloma patients. And so I convened a group of mates and we delivered in March the My Manalyzer Run and Fun Festival.
It was such an amazing day, and I was so lucky to be a part of, you know, the beginning of the idea, which started in a balance. You know, what do you want to do with this, Jeff? And he's like, I want to do a fun run. You know, some sort of community event where I could be surrounded by, you know, kids and my friends and, you know, extended family and all those wonderful things. And next thing you know, with a lot of work of a big team of people. We ended up getting 1,000 people there on the day.
Yeah, we did, and we raised $30,000 or over $30,000, which was amazing as well. And we got amazing support. The thing that I got most from it was meeting people. I met hundreds of people in my community, both people that wanted to have something directly to do with the festival, other people that wanted to just indirectly be a part of it by contributing or being present, donating. You know, for me, it wasn't all about the money. Money was secondary it was a secondary goal.
It's a purpose.
Yeah, it was. The purpose was when you get diagnosed with myeloma, you quickly find out that, you know, the average age of diagnosis being 70, you're surrounded by an older demographic. And so I wanted to bring myeloma into the younger person space, into the family space, into the space that I exist in. So it was all about getting young families together, having kids with face paint, having, who have been on jumpy castles and done a small run. Yeah. And having adults who have done something to contribute positively to their own well-being in having gone for a run or a walk around our gorgeous Mornington Peninsula and contributed to a really worthwhile cause.
I'm glad Simone wasn't there because she'd be the one out on the jumpy castle going, get off, kids, this is my turn. This is my turn.
Bouncing out left and right.
Absolutely.
So whilst our discussion started in treatment, you know, where my body's in the treatment space, my mind is in the, okay, what's the next big audacious thing that I want to do? Or what's the most simplistic thing? How do I get myself out of bed on days where I'm really challenged to walk my kids to school? Because that's what means something, and that's what I'll hopefully be remembered for when I die at the age of 80.
That is a great motivating factor, your kids, like getting out of bed for your kids. And that's a really good bucket list to have, because that does get you out of bed in the morning.
It really does. Yeah. It really does, for better or for worse.
Even though the fact that they come and jump on the bed and get you out of bed.
yeah. And, you know, obviously behind every great man is an amazing woman.
Yeah.
So Sarah's been an incredible strength for you and support. A real nurturer.
She is, like, you know, to put a label on it, Sarah's been my carer for the past 3 years. You know, the role of the carer is just so understated.
Yeah.
You know, I'm the person that gets all the attention because I'm the one that, you know, is going through, you know, who's living the diagnosis. But Sarah lives the diagnosis just as much as I do. And she's got to provide primary care to me in my most challenging times. Yeah.
And even harder is her lack of control, because at least, like you said, you trust you as a person and how strong you are and determined and stubborn you are.
Yeah.
I'm going to be here till I'm 80. You know, but from her point of view, it's once removed again, where all she can do is, you know, nurture and care for you, but she can't necessarily change anything.
No, she's got a tough gig. Got a very tough gig. And you know, I'm your highly extroverted type person. Sarah's not as much. And so, you know, she also worries about me putting myself out there so much, wanting to do all these big audacious things, when in reality all she wants to do is see me concentrating solely on myself, being as well as I can, you know, safe.
Naturally. Yeah, as a father of her children and a gorgeous life partner, her soulmate.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's the challenging part. Well, we're here for all of you. And what I love about, you know, hearing your story is the amount of people that have, you know, sort of rallied around to support you. I think particularly, you know, both of the stem cell transplants, but that second one, we were all a bit worried about you. And I heard that just people came from everywhere.
I feel really, really lucky in that I've had so many people come in and support us, whether it's cooking meals for us. Like, you know, last night I had a person whom I've never met come in and drop a meal off to us, sort of thing.
That's beautiful.
It is lovely, you know. And that's why I was so motivated to deliver the My Metalizer Run and Fun Festival, to engage the community. And it was a way of me saying thank you to the community. And now they keep giving. And so now what have I got to do next in order to thank them for this time around? You know, I feel so blessed and so lucky to have such an amazing group of family, friends around me to support us through what are challenging times. But it's the support that we get that's going to get us to 80, because, you know, why would you want to leave?
Yeah, for sure. You got some more shenanigans to create.
Yeah, hey, that's right too. No Kate Sobrano concert to go to.
That's right. We'll make sure she comes back down.
Yeah, plays at the 21st Century Dance Club.
Yeah, 21st Century.
Oh, this time I won't lie, so I'll only get grounded for 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's it. You know what? Kate would do that. She would. She's such an amazing person.
Maybe we'll get her to play
person.
At the festival. Yeah. What do you think?
I think she would do that for sure. Yeah.
Well, watch your space, people.
We'll have a chat to her on the 11th.
Yeah, well, she's Nan's BFF now.
She's my best friend.
Check you out.
Yeah, for sure.
Pull some strings.
Anyway, hey, now where are we heading? Because obviously it's been wonderful talking to you. We've only got a couple more minutes to go. So, you know, what's next for you from a charity point of view, from your blogging point of view, presenting?
Yeah, look, I think at the moment it's just around keeping – I've got to keep my head low. As I said, I'm mm-hmm. about to go through the next really challenging phase of treatment with this next stem cell transplant, which, you know, all kicks off on the 22nd of June. But in the meantime, I do what I do. It's about remaining engaged with people and having fun, staying connected with the people that I love and the people who love me. And that I'm lucky in that that's growing. You know, people who want to connect with my story, I blog on my website. It's jeffnyssen.com, jeffnyssen.com. So if you want to stay in touch with my story, it's going to be there. I guess I'll just do what I can to be the best that I can be and as I said, keep cancer as the small part of my life and focus on the big parts of my life.
Fantastic attitude.
I know, amazing. And we hope to have you back in the next couple of months.
Yes.
Looking forward to it.
Not only to hear the next chapter in your life, but also as a co-host, which would be fantastic. But thank you again for your time, hey.
Not at all. Thanks for having me on.